Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast diving deep into nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss the readings for the 24th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 32, or Proper 27, which this year falls on November 12th. We'd also like to invite you one last time to join us for our listener survey to let us know all the things that you love about the podcast, all the things that you would love to hear in the podcast, and all of the things that under no circumstances should we ever, ever, ever include in the podcast. Feel free to be
creative with that.
But we would love to hear your thoughts in general as we figure out what we're going to go to next after the end of this lectionary year, which is coming up in like 3 weeks. So please do sign up for our listener survey. We would love to hear from you, and we will absolutely not be selling your information to anyone ever, mostly because we're not that organized, but also because that would be bad.
Indeed. You can find the listener survey at bit.ly/NAC listener survey.
We do have a content notification for our first reading. We have a brief mention of a school shooting.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
So for our deep dive this week, given that our gospel reading is very enthusiastic about the importance of lamps, we thought that we would do a deep dive into lighting in history, the way that we have lit our homes and spaces over the centuries and millennia has changed considerably, mostly for good. I think, like, I'm in favor of how this works now compared to how it worked a long time ago, especially in how it affects my life and being able to actually see things. I mean, mostly. My glasses only allow so much, but it's better than it would have been. So let's talk about how have people lit their lives over the centuries.
Indeed. So the first and perhaps the most obvious is that it started all with God, or so we say in our faith in Genesis 1. God says, let there be light, and thus is light created. If you want a bit of a more detailed explanation of that, you can check out our episode from our first season where we did a deep dive into the Big Bang Theory for that. But joking aside, the first light that we had was natural light from the sun and from the moon, which is just light reflected from the sun. And it remains to this day the most important source of light for us. It also provides a significant amount of heat, which is helpful.
As a Minnesotan, I'm feeling that deeply right now.
As a Coloradan and the only person who apparently did not get a snow-filled Halloween, I'm feeling it in a different way. Mm. But it is nice and It is finally fall here.
I have adopted Minnesota.
So the sun definitely, like, outside is an easy light source, but a lot of buildings also do their best to make use of light. Stained glass buildings do in a way that also, like, blocks most of the light from coming into the building. But one of the most well-known examples of architecture, historically speaking, is the Pantheon, which uses natural light to light the room coming in from the top. And so that's part of the architectural achievements of the Roman Empire, that there is an open air circle at the top to let light in, but just the use even more broadly of natural lighting and strategic architecture to take advantage of it.
Yeah. I will also throw out there that one of my favorite childhood science lessons was when we learned about the concept of earthshine. So when there's a full moon or a half moon or a crescent moon, we're seeing it and it's very bright to us in the sky, whatever time of day it is, because it's directly reflecting sunlight that has hit the moon, gone straight from the sun to the moon. But sometimes when the moon is not directly reflecting that sunlight because the earth is between the sun and the moon, some of that light will come from the sun, reflect off the earth, and then bounce onto the moon. And so it's a lot softer and darker, but you can still sort of see the moon then, and that is called earthshine. And Leonardo da Vinci figured out how all that worked.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. I don't think I knew that that was where the concept of moonshine came.
It wasn't directly reflecting sunlight. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, earthshine and moonshine are different things. One will get you very, very drunk.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know that there's an earthshine version of moonshine. It kind of sounds like it would involve more dirt, but I'm Hopefully not too much.
Now I kind of want to ask Brooke, do a Sabbath Sips Earthshine episode.
With Leonardo da Vinci, who would probably be very happy to discover a new drink, from what I've heard of him. Yeah.
Nice.
And so one of the very earliest methods that humans figured out how to, you know, not just have light, but have reasonably portable light that they could move around to different places instead of, say, a campfire that you only have a certain amount of control over, was torches. Mm-hmm. And to make a torch, you can either soak a strip of cloth, usually in oil, and then wrap that around the end of a club, usually made out of wood, or you could wrap the end of the club in resinous material from trees. I'm thinking that's probably like the oily stuff between the bark and the wood on a tree. When you chop down a tree and take the bark off, there's some oily stuff under there. And so if you wrap that around the end of a club, you could light that on fire. And it's kind of sticky, so it would stick there.
What about sap? Is that what we're talking
about? Sap would be part of the stuff that is making that sticky, yes.
Okay.
So a torch will provide a good amount of light, but it's only for a limited time and it makes a lot of smoke.
So not great for cave dwellers.
I mean, on the one hand, you could carry it with you, and that was super useful. But on the other hand, you only want them burning for a little while.
Gotcha. And then from that evolved oil lamps or fat lamps, lamps in general.
Yes.
And they first date back to 4500 BCE. That's when we have the first lamps that are kind of existing. And they were originally made from rocks that had depressions, either natural or human ground into them.
Yeah.
And later it shifted to ceramic and metal lamps, and you would add an amount of oil or melted animal fat with a string coiled in it, and then light the string and it would burn for a long time with minimal light, but not nearly as much smoke as a torch. And so that's actually still used a lot today in churches and worship spaces, where they will fill candles that are not real candles with oil.
Sure.
And have a wick and burn it that way.
Not so much animal fat, though.
Yeah, not so much animal fat. Also, the genie's lamp in Aladdin was meant to be this kind of a lamp, although the cartoon rendering of it was not actually like the normal shape that it took. They were usually rounder and shorter than that. And nowadays you can make one of these by melting a candle and putting a string in it. It is a common suggestion for people in hurricanes. And ultimately, the jump in technology when it comes to lamps happened in 1780 when François-Pierre Amédée Argand, I'm sorry for French speakers, invented the central draft fixed oil lamp, which produced 6 to 10 candelas, which is the amount of light produced by a candle worth of light. So it's the equivalent of 6 to 10 candles. And then 4 years later, added a glass chimney. So if you've ever heard of a hurricane lamp, a cylinder of glass that keeps the flame of a lamp from going out, but still allows air and oxygen to get in. So it just kind of protects the flame.
There are a bunch of the really old-fashioned oil lamps from biblical times shown in the TV series The Chosen, if you've been watching that. I have some church folks who are fascinated.
Gotcha. Also, it's what's referred to in the gospel song, Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning. And I think in the kids song that we used to sing in Sunday school of like, give me oil for my lamps, keep me burning.
I'm not sure. I grew up with that one.
Lamps, okay. I pray.
I grew up with the gospel song.
My guess is, as with many camp and kid songs in church, my guess is it comes from the gospel song, and
sure,
we just took it totally out of its context and meaning and made it sound like a kid song.
Yeah. So when it comes to candles, you have essentially two kinds of candles. There are tallow candles and beeswax candles, which depend on what they're made out of. Tallow, again, is made from animal fat. I guess one way to describe it is that it's sort of concentrated animal fat. It's more solid than just straight lard would be. really. And these candles would have a similar amount of smoke to an oil lamp, which is not a ton, but it is noticeable. And there's also a slight smell to them that's kind of similar to cooking meat. It's not a really strong smell, but you can tell the difference between a tallow candle and a beeswax candle, in part because of that smell. Whereas beeswax candles have a slightly less smoke than tallow candles, and really pretty much no smell, or a very slight. Like, you can tell that something's on fire, but it's not a huge thing.
It's almost pleasant smell, though. The smell of beeswax in general just has this, like...
And since beeswax is less plentiful and, you know, you actually have to put some work into it compared to just having animal fat around when you're regularly slaughtering animals, then the beeswax candles were always sort of the fancy version. These are more expensive and were often in demand by churches in particular over the history of the church. And you make either kind of candle by dipping the string into vats of either the tallow or the wax. And you could make very thin tapers, which burn quite quickly. And a taper like that was often used for just lighting other candles very quickly. Or you could make fatter candles, like votive candles, that have a lot more tallow or wax to them, and those burn a much longer time. These do take more work to make than just having an oil lamp, and so even tallow candles, historically, I believe, cost more than just getting oil for your lamp instead. But once candles could be made in a way that they would burn consistently, measurably about the same each time, they could also be used to keep time. You would mark notches in the candle once you learned how quickly a candle of that substance and thickness burned, and say mark off hours, and various workplaces would use those to keep track of when the workers were supposed to go home because they wouldn't have an actual clock, that kind of thing. Of course, there are also, because we are human, documented cases of people figuring out how to mark those just slightly wrong in order to make more money.
Of course.
Yeah. And later on, someone figured out how to make a candle holder with a mirror or a shiny surface on one side of it in order to reflect, direct, and increase the amount of light that would be put off by the candle, which you have probably seen historical pictures of both candles and lamps using those.
Yeah. And today, some people also use soy to make candles.
Sure. Yeah, that's much more.
As a non-animal alternative. Sure. But yeah, some people in churches, there's a big push for beeswax candles in churches, especially in the like fancy high liturgy ones. And then some people say, well, it's job security for the bees, which is...
We're really never going to stop eating honey, like as much as the vegans may or may not want us to, depending on which vegans you talk to. I think the bees have plenty of job security.
Yeah, and that doesn't actually protect them from the poisons that we also emit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then kerosene lamps developed kind of after candles, and that's part of a shift towards, again, lamps and bigger lights that kind of reached further. And kerosene burns much cleaner with less smoke than oil does. And so these were popular once we got to the point where we could make metal and ceramic lamps in large numbers. And so then we could like produce kerosene lamps so that more people could have access to them. And often, as with candles, as you mentioned, Kay, they used reflective surfaces to increase the light that was produced. Kerosene is much more flammable than animal fat, so there was, at the same time, an increase in fire hazard.
Yeah. Yeah, you could absolutely, like, blow things up with kerosene lamps, let alone just set them on fire. However, also, having both smelled a tallow candle versus a kerosene lamp, kerosene kind of has a pleasant sort of cleaning smell to it. It's not an unpleasant smell. And remember that because of the amount of lamps that you'd need in your home, you'd have a bunch of these, probably. And so the smell really did matter. So when we talk about what kind of lamps or candles or whatever did people prefer, the smell also becomes a quality that folks were noticing and paying attention to. And so then we come to gas lighting.
Not to be confused with gas lighting, the terrible, horrible thing that people do to make you question your understanding of reality.
Yeah. Emotional manipulation, bad. Gas lighting, was very useful for a time, which is to say lighting created from gas. So in 1802, William Murdoch in England lit the outside of his Soho foundry, which I believe was a place where they built steam engines for trains. And that was in Smethwick, England. He lit the outside of his foundry with gas lights in 1802. He had started to experiment with gas lighting about 10 years before that. The exact date is a little fuzzy, historically speaking. And the first public street lighting by gas happened in Newport, Rhode Island in 1805 or 1806, thereabouts. And then also in the Pall Mall neighborhood of London in 1807. And gas lighting as a whole did not actually last very long historically, because electric lighting showed up very quickly afterwards and became cheaper very quickly. So you started seeing gas lights in this very early 1800s, and by and large, they were mostly phased out by the 1930s. And they became steadily less and less and less used throughout that time. But the reason why gas lighting became very popular in populated areas, cities and suburbs, because it produced a lot of light very reliably, but it did also require a lot of infrastructure, pipes to distribute the gas, that kind of thing. And so this gas, which was often either wood gas or coal gas, and I'll get to what those are and how they're produced in a minute, this gas would be sent through these pipes and ignited at, for example, the top of a lamppost or at an indoor light fixture in your hallway or in your rooms. And at first, these light fixtures or lampposts had to be lighted by a person who either had a taper or a lighter of some kind. This person would be called a lamplighter if they were in charge of lighting the public lampposts on a street, for example. And that was an actual job people had. And if you were a lamplighter, the lighter that you would carry would be on the end of a very long stick, so that you didn't actually have to constantly carry a ladder with you and climb up and down to light the light at the top of a lamppost. And those lighters kind of remind me of the one that my aunt has for her flamethrower now, which is something she uses to melt the snow when it gets very snowy in Michigan. You can also use it to kill weeds with in a very environmentally friendly way, as long as you don't accidentally set your whole lawn on fire or say your wooden porch, which was really only a problem once. And then she figured out how to not do that again. Be very careful on windy days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was an exciting afternoon, apparently.
Sounds exciting.
But later on, after a while, they figured out how to make light fixtures and lampposts created with an igniter at the place where the gas started coming out, which you could trigger with a switch at a more easy to reach place. And so there might still be lamplighters, but they just went around flipping the switches instead, or people in their homes would flip switches instead of having to use a taper or igniter that they would hold in their hand.
Okay, so Mary Poppins then would have been between those two, because there are lamplighters in Mary Poppins, and they don't just flip a switch.
Right. And I think eventually they figured out how to turn on a bunch of lampposts with one switch that was probably like in a box that you had to use a key to get into or something. But yeah, that took a while. However, the thing about gas lighting is that if the gas was allowed to escape for too long before the gas was lit from the light fixture, you could set a whole house on fire remarkably easily. Mm-hmm. Like, the way this worked is that the gas would come out and then you would light the gas. And if there was too much gas out of the fixture already, that turned into an explosion, not just a fire. And it's very similar to if any of you have gas stoves and have had to deal with the pilot light going out and having to be relit. It's very similar to a pilot light. Of course, these days we are now phasing out gas stoves, so we won't be able to use that explanation for much longer anymore.
Yeah, which is also a bummer, because gas stoves are one of the like more effective in terms of like cooking. Like, you can get something hot really fast and you can take it off the heat really fast, as opposed to like electrical, which is like,
I grew up with a gas stove, and there is a part of my brain that still judges how much heat is being put into the stuff by the height of the flame rather than whatever the marking on the electric stove is, which doesn't really tell me much. And so I understand that. But also, like, the scientific testing that's been going on about how we are actually steadily poisoning ourselves with gas through gas stoves is a little terrifying. So I'm not against the concept of phasing that out entirely. I just, it has issues. Yeah. So
I did not know that about the gas stoves poisoning.
Oh, yeah, no, that's why they're phasing them out. I mean, also the whole don't blow yourself up thing, but mostly the fact that the residual effect from having the gas in your home over the course of a lifetime is noticeable and not great, and does things, I think, to your lung capacity in particular. So,
yeah. Okay. Noted. Uh-huh.
So what is this wood or coal gas that people were using for their gas lights? Well, if you burn wood, wood gas is one of the materials created from that, along with like soot and ash and so on. And in a campfire or an outdoor fire, that gas will escape. But if you capture it instead, it can be used for gas lighting. But the thing about wood gas is that it contains a lot of extra materials in it, the soot and so on, the extra stuff. And those are basically contaminants, and so it irritates the throats of people nearby, it makes a noticeable smell, it also just makes the quality of the light that's created less consistent and reliable, because it'll flicker a lot more because of all that extra stuff in it, and it builds up inside the pipes over time, which is not great.
But it is great for campfires.
Well, yeah, I mean campfires are great, but you're not putting the gas from a campfire into a pipe and trying to put it into somebody's house.
I mean, okay, but you do come away smelling like campfire.
Yes, although I think a decent chunk of the smell is actually the soot and the ash, but sure.
I suppose.
Yeah. Whereas if you heat coal to be very hot without having regular air around it, you put it into a container of some type and heat it, there is a chemical reaction that happens that produces a very flammable gas, which is about half carbon monoxide and half hydrogen. And this gas is easy to create, but unbelievably flammable, as you might imagine, having heard that it's half hydrogen and half carbon monoxide. And also, the smell is less actively unpleasant than the wood gas smell, so the coal gas became more popular, and this was used in a number of homes, but also, you know, all those stories about people setting their houses on fire with gas lights. I mean, the wood gas happened too, but the coal gas was more likely to blow up your house, which is pretty terrifying. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, keep in mind that while we do have a lot more safeguards today, like electric lighting has also been known to set people's houses on fire. So it's not like we've completely eliminated that risk now.
I mean, fair. Yeah. But also, like, that gas is extremely toxic, right?
Yes.
Carbon monoxide kills
people. Yeah, no, that
literally
poisons you. And my understanding is that is also not the kind of gas that is used in gas stoves today. That's natural gas, which is a whole different thing, and smells very different indeed. So,
yeah. And we've, like, added scent to natural gas, I
on
think,
purpose.
So that you can
Yeah, that is actually
that
one of
there.
The few things that I can smell very easily. I am apparently one of those people who will notice the smell of propane because of those added things to it faster than most of people around me, I have found. I have been the first person to notice a propane leak, like, 4 or 5 times now, which is a weird talent
Duly
to have
noted.
When your nose doesn't really work for other things. But and then if you are interested in a story that involves a lot of gas lights, you can watch a Ninth Doctor episode of the series Doctor Who called The Unquiet Dead, which is also known as the Charles Dickens episode, and involves, you know, they're not exactly zombies, but
which involves not exactly zombies.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if Horror Nerd at Church will ever do a BooTube episode on that one. But it is a good episode.
Probably. We've done Doctor Who twice for BooTubes, so it would not be out of the realm of possibilities. Maybe someday when we're doing a zombies season.
Yeah, and if you're still in a Halloween mood, even though Halloween is now past, that's also a great episode to watch to be in a Halloween-y kind of mood.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great transition episode into more Christmassy mood, because you know who wrote A Christmas Carol?
Yeah.
Charles Dickens.
Absolutely. Hmm.
I'm in that space of, like, trying to find movies that will satisfy my need.
We are still
my,
in,
like,
decorative gourd
cravings.
Season, Emily. Like, enjoy decorative
know.
Gourd season. It only lasts so long.
I'm trying, okay. But also in my
More
body's
nutmeg.
Memory, we should have snow on the ground. And so when my body doesn't have snow on the ground, and it should, it starts into Christmas mode, because Christmas means snow.
Well, sure,
Christmas
but we're also not
Christmas
into
Christmas
Advent yet.
Snow.
We've got weeks left.
That depends. Some people are starting Advent this week. The people who do, like, the 7-week
Advent. Oh, yes.
Advent.
Okay, that's right.
I'm just saying.
We're not into normal Advent yet.
Since when did we value normalcy?
Well, let's not tell God what to do about weather, because historically speaking, I feel like that has not always worked out well.
I am not trying to tell God what to do about weather. I'm just explaining why my body is like Christmas!
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, Next up was the big evolution of light and lighting, which came with electricity. So the first electric light was created by Englishman Humphrey Davy. And according to the U.S. Department of Energy, Davy demonstrated the first incandescent light to the Royal Institute in Great Britain using a bank of batteries and two charcoal rods. So that invention is usually called an arc light, and there are modern day versions that still are being used today. And then in 1879, Thomas Edison, who is probably the most well known when it comes to electricity, set out to invent a long lasting electric light bulb so that it could compete with gas lighting, especially indoor. And his first real success was October 22nd, 1879, and he had an incandescent light that burned for 13 and a half hours. And then a few months after that, he discovered a carbonized bamboo filament that burned for 1,200 hours. Ooh. And that was like the big, big jump in lighting and stuff. And that's the kind of light bulb used in the Joan of Arcadia episode where God is an electrician talking to Joan and at one point says, like, let there be light, and screws in the light bulb and the light bulb turns on. And it's glorious, except that you really shouldn't be screwing light bulbs in when the lights are already on.
Please don't electrocute yourself. We would really love to not get sued.
But also, God is God, so if God wants to...
Yeah, God's not going to electrocute God's self. Presumably.
Yeah. And then one of the big kind of controversies that happened around this was Edison and Tesla. So Tesla was working for Thomas Edison, and then they got into a disagreement over payment. And so Nikola Tesla formed a partnership with Robert Lane and Benjamin Vail and tried to design an arc lighting system, so a new kind of way of doing lights with fail switches and automatic adjustments and stuff. And the investors weren't actually very interested in Tesla's ideas when it came to like motors and electrical transmission equipment, and so ended up being like, we'll just go for a new electrical utility, and created an electric light in the Union County Electric Light and Manufacturing Company, which basically put Tesla Electric Light and Manufacturing out of business and left Tesla penniless. And like to the extent that he even lost the patents that he had for the stuff that he had created. So that's, you know, sucks to be you, really, Tesla. Yeah. And there's a whole bunch that could be said today, too, about Tesla. But that's a different kind of
conversation. Not founded by Elon Musk.
Yeah. And then as electric lighting kind of progressed, we got high-intensity discharge lamps. So fluorescent lights were introduced commercially by Daniel McFarlane Moore around 1904. And the early ones were like high voltage, non-standard connectors, but relatively high efficiency compared to the incandescent ones of Edison and the like. And so there was competition there, even though it was a lot harder to do. And then General Electric improved incandescent technology by introducing the tungsten filament. And at the same time, around 1901, Peter Cooper Hewitt developed the first mercury vapor light, which was both high efficiency and compatible with standard electrical infrastructure, but as you might suspect, involved mercury.
Poison.
Which tends to be pretty toxic. Yeah. So that's, you know, suboptimal, as they say. But also among that, and this is kind of jumping ahead but kind of related, is flashlights, or if you're in the UK, torches, are basically handheld electric lamps. And those came about with the invention of the dry cell, which is like early batteries, right? Because they needed batteries to function. And so the first battery-powered flashlights were made possible around 1899. So all of this is kind of happening at the same time as electricity powers lights. Also, batteries are getting developed. And so lights get to be movable with electricity as well as kind of the stay where they are lights. And some flashlights have solar powers to recharge them. Some have batteries. There's everything from like handheld to like lantern style to headlamps.
Yeah.
At camp, one of the things that's cool with water and glass that you kind of talked about, Kay, in like how gas lamps, I think, were evolving, is you can put a flashlight under a bottle of water. Mm-hmm. And as long as it'll stay, it actually becomes its own lamp and disperses the light a lot more broadly than if you just have like a flashlight.
Yeah.
So I always think that that's cool because I love headlamps and I love flashlights.
Sure. So remembering that, historically speaking, one of the concerns about your source of light was, what did it smell like? Once electric lights got kind of up and going, that was no longer really an issue. Because if your electric light smelled, mm-hmm. that was really a bad sign and you should have an electrician come visit you. Speaking of which, I feel like I should point out that one of the warning signs for one of the plugs in your home going bad, one of the electrical outlets going bad, is a smell of fish. If you smell fish and there is no fish, call an electrician. Good, because that means something is melting in your wall.
Oh.
Yeah. So instead of the concern of what does it smell like, one of the concerns for electric lights became, how warm is it? An incandescent bulb will put off some heat, but it's not a huge amount of heat, but over time it becomes noticeable. A high mm-hmm. discharge bulb, or an HD bulb, which were still popular about 25 years ago, because I know I got a lamp that was meant for an HD bulb when I was in middle school. Those put off a lot of extra light. They are extremely bright, but they also put off a ton of heat. I remember while I was in middle school conducting very scientific experiments with my HD lamp by putting a crayon up to the glass of the lamp and the crayon would melt, which you can't do with an incandescent bulb. And then fluorescent bulbs don't get anywhere near as warm, but they also, like, look, I'm sorry, everyone hates fluorescent light. It's terrible.
It's
gives a lot of people headaches. I can't, it doesn't give me headaches, but I still can't stand it. The flickering when the bulb starts going bad is also terrible.
Also, though, I don't remember which light bulb, but for those of us who grew up with Easy Bake ovens, that's basically an oven powered by a light bulb.
Yes, I think that is an incandescent bulb, actually. But if you let them burn for long enough, they do put out a little heat. Whereas a light-emitting diode, or an LED light, puts off almost no heat at all. And so they have particularly become popular in lights for small spaces, and also lights for spaces that you don't get to very often, because they also last about 5 to 10 times or even longer than an incandescent bulb does. And so they get really popular for like lights in your crawl space, or lights in your RV, or lights that you don't want a lot of heat and don't want to have to replace regularly.
Yeah. And they also use less electricity.
Yes, they do. So, although I'm a little unclear on like how does the environmental impact play out regarding how we get the materials to make an LED bulb versus how do we get the materials to make an incandescent bulb. So I think we're still figuring that out.
That is unclear, but yeah.
However, LED lighting is a solid state light, or an SSL, which does not require a glass housing like traditional bulbs, and it produces light by converting electrical current using a semiconductor. The first LED was invented in the 1960s by General Electric scientist Nick Holonyak. I hope I pronounced your name correctly, sir, who called it the magic one.
Yeah. And we have LEDs. We were trying to replace our lighting in our living room because we got like the fancy, the change color lights and stuff. So we were like, oh, we'll like do that so that we can do that for our living room. And then like at night when people have to go to the bathroom, there's still light, but it's not bright light. And the lamps that we have like from the ceiling are basically just LED circles. So you can't replace it with light bulbs.
Yeah.
So we're like, well, that's unfortunate. But yeah. But speaking of color changing lights, that brings us to black lights, which is a different type of light. So black lights have to do with ultraviolet light. So there are a bunch of different ways that you can create ultraviolet light, light bulbs and stuff. You can just paint ultraviolet filters on stuff, but there's also like ways to make it as part of the light itself. And that's really where black light comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And black lights actually date back to 1903. And the optical filter glass called wood glass was the original way of making a black light that today is not really used because it just takes a lot more supplies and stuff. And so it's just not as easy to make as other ways of making black light, from slapping on a UV paint on the bulb to other forms of doing it. But Wood's glass was developed as a light filter for communications during World War I, which I thought was really interesting. And the glass filter worked both in infrared daylight communication and ultraviolet night communication because it would remove the visible components of a light beam and leave only the, like, quote-unquote, invisible radiation as a signal beam. And so Wood's glass was commonly used to form the envelope for fluorescent and incandescent, or UV bulbs, which is black lights. But again, other filter materials have largely replaced that because of the disadvantages that also came with Wood's light.
Yeah.
You know, because we make advancements in a century, usually.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's infrared light, which, much like natural light, was invented by God. And so we did not so much create or invent infrared light as we did invent ways to detect it, since it's a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that was, again, invented by God. And infrared light is found on the spectrum between visible light and microwaves.
Mm-hmm. And finally, wrapping things up, we have disco balls, which are not light, but are a delightful use of light.
Reflect the glory of light, you might say. Yes.
Exactly, exactly. Reflect the glory of light. They were first widely used in nightclubs in the 1920s, having been patented in 1917. And it ties in with the refracting light and mirrors and magnification and all of that stuff that really will have to be another deep dive because there's so much.
Although I think we did address some of it in our previous deep dive on prisms and how light.
Oh, yeah. A prisms for Holy Trinity this year. So you can get some about mirrors and magnification and refracting light in our deep dive from Holy Trinity this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let there be light, folks.
Yeah.
Are you curious about how the Twilight Saga is influenced by Mormon theology?
Or why so many vampires are queer-coded?
Have you sat up at night pondering if the documentary Jesus Camp counts as a horror film?
Or have you ever wondered which slasher icon is which member of the Trinity?
Do you ever get into debates about whether the movies Casper, Ghost, and Candyman can be part of the Ghostbusters expanded universe?
Have you watched most of the Nightmare on Elm Street series before the age of 10?
What? Who does that?
Okay, maybe that one's just me. But if you answered yes to any of the other questions, then we've got the podcast for you.
And if you answered yes to Pace's question.
That too. I'm Pace, and I am the super nerdy horror person who's been a horror fan since well before the age when it was appropriate to watch these movies.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the inevitable queer coding somewhere in every horror movie. And we are the hosts of Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast hosted by two non-binary trans nerds.
Each season, we follow a horror franchise and a host of other horror and horror-adjacent movies to talk about how they connect to queerness, religion, and theology.
We feature bona fide scary movies like Halloween, The Witch, Candyman, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria.
We also have non-scary movies or low-stake horror movies like Ghostbusters, The Addams Family, Doctor Strange, and Hocus Pocus.
Our upcoming season, we are covering a galaxy far, far away by looking at the Star Wars and Alien franchises from queer, religious, and horror points of view.
So whether you're a lifelong horror master like me,
or a horror Padawan like me,
we have a place for you at Horror Nerds at Church.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Speaking of light and what God does or does not bring, our first reading is from Amos chapter 5, verses 18 through 24. God has no patience or interest for rituals and assemblies in place of righteousness and justice. And so one of the themes in this passage is just like disingenuousness, where it's your heart is not in this thing. There's just like a disconnect between the thing and what is true and all of that stuff. And it just reminded me of, you know, a certain government spending millions, billions of dollars looking for billionaires in a submersible vessel when they knew within about 30 seconds that they had died and it had imploded.
Yeah.
You know, disingenuous, because there were other people who were drowning actively that could have used that help.
Who were, you know, immigrants, possibly?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So as we jump into the verses, in verse 19 we read, "As if someone fled from a lion and was met by a bear, or went into the house and rested a hand against the wall and was bitten by a snake." Okay, so not so much that second part, but the first part is something that can actually happen when you're playing Skyrim, which came out in 2011, and many people are still playing today, in part because of the very active mod community, and by many people, I mean me, and... you can totally run away from a saber cap and bump into a bear, or into a pack of wolves, or into a giant. And so you want to be careful when you're running around Skyrim, because this can happen pretty easily, and especially if you run into a giant, because if you anger a giant and they hit you with their club, and they always have a club, you will become a part of what's known as the Skyrim Space Program. Which is to say, you will fly very high into the air, possibly higher than any of the mountains in the game, and that will result in your untimely death when you get back to the ground at terminal velocity. Unless you manage to actually take a paralysis potion in the middle there, but usually it won't let you open your menu while you're flying around like that. Hilariously, it turns out that the whole thing of you getting thrown into the air that high by the Giant's Club was actually a glitch in the programming for the game, and so at one point, the company removed the glitch from the game, and people complained so much because they loved the Skyrim Space Program joke that they put it back in, which I love. It is one of the most human things I've ever heard.
That is fantastic, and I absolutely love that. Yeah. Also, I love how scientifically you said you get thrown up in the air and then crash land and die.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And then in verse 21, we read, "I hate, I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies." And it reminded me of a reinterpretation that I did that's actually ended up becoming a Sojourner's article that we can link to after the shooting in Uvalde, Texas. That was, "I hate, I despise your vigils, and I take no delight in your school shooter drills. Even though you offer me your thoughts and prayers, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your collection plates, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your lament. I will not listen to the melody of your tears, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream."
Oh. Amen. Mm-hmm. And then on a lighter note, in verse 22b, we read, "And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals I will not look upon." Okay, so how exactly you understand the grammar of this part of the sentence impacts how you understand what the sentence means, right? So I am fairly certain that the way I'm about to take it is probably not the way that you're supposed to take it. If we're talking about the well-being of fatted animals, which I assume means well-fed animals or animals fed in a careful way, the well-being of those animals is an offering to God. Does that mean that keeping one's pets well-fed and happy is an offering to God? I kind of like that thought. You're taking care of creation. And so does that mean that feeding them and cleaning your litter box is a spiritual practice?
Ooh.
Maybe. You know, if it helps you clean the litter box more often, then more power to you.
Then probably, yes. Yeah. And then in verse 24, we read, "But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." And aside from Martin Luther King Jr.'s voice in my head, I also had simultaneously, "Don't go chasing waterfall." Pop into my head. And then also the waters in Frozen 2 when Anna breaks the dam that was hurting the land and the waters just come flooding down. And because she did it, there's like a, you know, mystical, magical save the white people who did the bad thing thing. But yeah, I was like, that's what it was. It was coming down. They just got saved.
And our second reading for this episode is from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 18. The author reassures a community in the midst of grief and fear.
So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of, like, weird encouragement. Like, this is just weird. A weird way to encourage people. But thanks, I guess. But it reminded me of the movie Encanto when Mirabel is encouraging Antonio, who is scared to do the ceremony to get his gift because what if he doesn't get one, or what if it doesn't go right? And Mirabelle, who went through the ceremony and didn't get a gift, a magic, like, special gift, has this beautiful way of, like, encouraging him that only she could do because she knows what it is like for it to not go the way that everybody expects. And so she, like, climbs under the bed with him where he's hiding and talks to him about stuff. It's just, like, beautiful.
Aww.
Yeah. And then as we dive into the verses in verse 13a, we read, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, siblings." And I, for this, will always think of Evan, the bioethicist on TikTok, who specializes in misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories as a threat to public health. And I have learned a lot, but it's been interesting before all of the violence and more active genocide that is currently happening in the Middle East to be, like, getting the insights into, like, how misinformation works, but also, like, where it's happening. And then now to have people working a lot harder to address misinformation, because there is so much of it, particularly related to the Middle East, but also just more broadly, it is out of control. God does not want, or the author does not want, misinformation.
On board. Sure.
So,
And if you're asking yourself about what, well, as we finish verse 13, we read about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. So, for the record, the author is talking about what has happened to those who have died after their death. The author is not talking about just listing the people who have died so that people, you know, don't have questions about who it is that have died. There are circumstances in which that sort of thing is important to do. However, this is not what we're talking about. And also, trying to start a church by going around listing the people who have died recently is a terrible evangelism tactic. Please do not try this. It sounds like a bad idea. In fact, it sounds like the kind of thing that the Fire Nation in Avatar The Last Airbender would have done to squash morale in various other areas. That's not
accurate.
That's not how you get a church going. And then in verse 15, we read, "For this we declare to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will by no means precede those who have died." And I do not remember which Sunday school teacher in my childhood that it was, but I'm pretty sure that one of them used this as a biblical example of God disapproving of line budging or line cutting. On the one hand, you know, having worked with kids myself, I completely understand the impulse. Like, I just want to say that, to be clear. On the other hand, not entirely sure that that's what the focus of this verse is, ma'am.
Yeah.
But I think they may have been a tad off base. Although that concept does now bring to mind the movie version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And also there's a similar scene in the previous miniseries version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but the movie version is the one that came to mind first, with Martin Freeman. There is a scene where the aliens who he's with, his friends, are completely flummoxed by the concept of waiting in a long line. But as a British person, he is an expert and well prepared for this experience, and he very carefully leads them through it. So
that's fantastic. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I might have to go revisit it.
The miniseries, which I think was made in like the late 70s, early 80s, is a trip and a half and has some terrible special effects that are just fabulous now.
And then in verse 16, we read, "For the Lord's own self, with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of God's trumpet, will descend from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise first." And it's this, like, big pageantry, fancy schmancy. And you know what? I bet God plays the trumpet way better than I ever did in middle school. I mean, I also, like, didn't want to play the trumpet. I wanted to play the saxophone and eventually switched to that. But I do imagine, though, it was very jazzy.
I would think so. Maybe for all the saints go marching in?
Yeah. Oh, that would be brilliant. Yeah.
I am also reminded of a friend of mine from college who played the trombone. And every so often when someone would mention the final trumpets, he would say, "Didn't you hear? It's been changed to trombones." He had the absolute perfect deadpan delivery for it, too.
I love it. And then our final reading for this episode is Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. Jesus tells the parable of the bridesmaids and their lamb. So one of the themes in this is the idea of preparation, right? Who is prepared and who is not for the unexpected. And it's kind of like when you're doing makeup or face paint and you have to prepare the skin and the face, because when you don't, the pink and the purple colors tend to stay on your face for longer than you would like. Not that I know this from experience at all. No, I didn't try to do a face for Halloween. Not at all. I actually know the colors from Pride, but sure. Still.
So as we jump into the verses, in verse 4, we read, "But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps." See, these days, in the social dissection of the wedding afterwards that always, always, always happens, this problem would have been blamed firmly on the bride rather than on the bridesmaids, only half of them having additional oil for their lamps, because why would the bride depend on the bridesmaids to provide lighting for the reception in the first place? And also, if she was going to do that, why wouldn't she give all of them matching oil flasks with the wedding date and the names of the couple on them as part of the wedding swag? Is the lack of planning down to the foolish bridesmaids, or were they foolish because they trusted the bride to provide them with what they needed?
Wow, that's some like misogyny there of like, it is all the bride's fault.
But having been through a wedding, when it comes to who people expect did most of the planning, accurate.
It's true. Yeah, hence the misogyny.
And then in verse 5, we read, "As the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and slept." And this actually did not come up in our wedding deep dive, although I kind of expected it to, but I think we were just too busy talking about the 5,000 other things. But yeah, if I have one pet peeve about weddings, and in particular, this is about wedding receptions, it's wedding parties who go off to take pictures and or drink between the ceremony and the reception. If you want to take like one or two pictures, that's usually fine. Like putting in an extra 15 minutes of space to make sure that people can get to the reception and get settled, I have no argument with that. But all too often it turns from 15 minutes to, you know, 60 or 75 or longer. Mm. And you leave the rest of the guests hungry and bored for an hour or more. What starts as a cocktail hour turns into the longest period of time you've ever experienced. And while the bar is always happy to sell you more drinks for actual money, you can't get a refill of ice water to save your life. Not that I have personal experience of this from a wedding that I was at for professional reasons. But you can take pictures before the ceremony. In fact, I would encourage you to take most of your pictures, if not all, before the ceremony. God will not smite you for briefly putting on your wedding ring before the ceremony in order to take pictures so that it will be in the pictures.
Also, it will not cause bad luck. No. To see the other person.
Oh, well, yeah, and you can do the first look thing, like, on your own in a different space.
Yeah, you can do pictures of it.
And if you want to take a picture of it, you can. You don't have to. My husband and I did a first look moment, just the two of us on our own, no photos. And that was very nice. Yeah. We liked that.
Yeah. I will say, I have been to weddings where they've done a cocktail hour between, and the ones that I love are the ones where it's a cocktail hour with some snacks.
Yes, appetizers are lovely.
Gotta have snacks, especially if you're giving people alcohol.
Oh, please goodness. Yeah.
Give them something to snack on too. And then it's fine. But yeah, like if there's any way going to be a transfer of location, it's an easy thing to slip in there.
Yeah. And keep in mind that some folks might be diabetic and haven't told you because, you know, there's various things around that. And so giving them snacks could save their lives. Snacks are important.
Yeah. Snacks save lives. Absolutely. That's really the heart of this passage. Yeah.
The rest of us just want to eat, so make sure your guests get to eat. And remember that when you plan your wedding, even Donna Noble's wedding party didn't do this to their guests, and she was accidentally abducted by an alien before the ceremony started. So this is not a very hard bar to pass.
Yeah, you know. It's true. Yeah, always provide snacks. I'm always a fan of that as someone who, like, is a vegetarian. And so, like, half the time, that's the food that I get is just the snacks. And then in verse 9, the wise bridesmaids reply to the foolish one who have requested them to share their oil. "No, there will not be enough for you and for us. You had better go to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And one of my favorite interpretations of this is from a friend of the podcast, Susanna Porter, who talks about that and church people and queer people, and that queer people have done so much work to, have a faith life to make, yeah. to like so much work on theology and all of that. And so then we come prepared, and then other people who have not done that work want to take our light and to keep us from shining that light so brightly. And so they're like, no, come to this setting that will not let you shine your light as well as it could, but will give everybody else just a teeny bit more light. And that's not actually what we're called to. We're called to let our lights shine. And yeah, so I just really love that. She talks about it in a pride vigil that we did. So I'll link to that for folks if they want to check it out. And then in verse 13, the like lesson on this is keep awake, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. And like, okay, but literally everyone actually fell asleep and that was not the problem. And also, insomnia is not actually good. Like, no one I know with insomnia, including occasionally myself, would be like, yeah, I love the insomnia and the laying awake in bed for hours at a time, staring at the ceiling, unable to fall asleep.
Yeah. Also, just for sheer accuracy, I feel I should point out that I think another way to interpret that particular Greek phrase is keep alert rather than keep awake. It's not instructing you to be an insomniac, but...
Details. Still doesn't work. The thing about it was the preparation, not the alertness.
Yes, absolutely.
Somebody will wake you up. Somebody will draw your attention. But are you ready for it?
Yeah. And, you know,
that's
hopefully it won't be a gaslight or explosion or your electric burning your house down. So. And now for our most shining segment. Let's make a Muppets musical.
Yeah. This one was hard because I kept thinking of Miss Piggy and the weddings and the wedding conversation that we already cast. And that is, you know, not the same as this particular episode, but also kind of the same. I don't know. But I could see Miss Piggy, like, having all the oil she needs and defending keeping her oil with, like, her piggy hi-ya. Chops.
Yeah. I think I am, on the other hand, being slightly inspired by Mother Jo from last week, who joined us, in the thought of beaker with some oil and conducting experiments with Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, because, of course, a beaker, an actual beaker, not the Muppet, could hold oil. It's another container that you could put oil in. And so beaker running around with oil and trying to perform different lighting experiments could be very fun.
That is true. That would be delightful. Yeah.
And less evil than, you know, beaker with explosives.
It's true.
Yeah.
Not an evil beaker. Yeah. Just regular beaker. I love beaker. Beaker's adorable. Yeah. We don't cast beaker enough. We should cast beaker more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, folks. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, and our Muppets music was by Brenda Boss. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 25th Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and now Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. With the approaching seasonal changes, I am reminded that it is definitely cheaper than a set of nice quality Advent candles.
True. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax Vobiscum.